Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Jonathan Gottschall says we spend much of our time in storyland, whether it's reading novels or daydreaming, listening to songs, watching TV, going to the movies, playing video games, or dreaming at night when we're asleep. Why do these fictional made-up worlds consume so much of our time and attention? That's the question Gottschall explores in his new book, The Storytelling Animal, where he writes, Neverland is our evolutionary niche, our special habitat. The book is subtitled How Stories Make Us Human. Well, we were intrigued and we asked him to join us on Radio Times. Jonathan Gottschall is an English professor at Washington and Jefferson College in Western Pennsylvania. His work focuses on the intersection of science and art, and he blogs at Psychology Today under The Storytelling Animal and joined us from WQED in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Jonathan Gottschall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book.
Oh, so nice to be here. Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. You talk about this Neverland. We are a creature of an imaginative realm we call Neverland. I certainly remember Neverland from Peter Pan. What's your description of Neverland?
Well, Neverland, you know, if you think about how we live life on Earth, I think there's this kind of tendency to think that, well, that we're Earthlings, that we live in the here and now. But really, we spend most of our lives in various kinds of Neverlands, in this sort of omnidimensional alternative reality. We think of children as living in Neverland. And they do.
Yes.
But we think of ourselves as sort of moving out of Neverland in late childhood, like, you know, 8 or 9 years old. But we never really do. We just change how we do Neverland. Instead of making up our own scenarios and acting them out, we increasingly enter into Neverlands made up by other people, TV, films, video games, and so forth.
And do you think there's something sort of biological about that, that we are attuned to stories and moved and compelled by stories?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's a sort of cultural bias. If you went to the English department at my university or any university, you'd hear that stories are cultural. They're influenced by culture. They influence culture, and that's absolutely true. But it's one-sided. Story is also as biological as a part of human nature as upright posture or opposable thumbs or big brains. It's part of what makes us human. So wherever you go around the world, you find stories. It doesn't matter how far you go back in world history or where you go in the badlands of anthropology. You always find that they're telling stories, and they're telling stories that are just like ours. And again, I think sort of the best evidence for this, a story as a sort of a natural human trait, a biological human trait, and not just a cultural one, is children's make-believe. Mm. Wherever you go in the world, you find children making up stories. They do it in the same sort of developmental stages. It doesn't matter if it's a slum or a suburb or a village or a city.
Well, and if it's biological, one would have to assume that it has something to do with survival and even with evolution.
Yeah, and I think there's this neat little thought experiment I like to do where I ask people to throw their minds back into the mists of prehistory and imagine there's just two tribes living side by side in some African valley, and they're in competition with each other. One of these tribes is going to pass away, and one of them is going to inherit the earth, and one of these tribes is called the story people, and one's called the practical people. Mm. And the tribes are alike in every way except the way indicated by their names. So they both hunt, they both gather, they both woo mates and rear children. But at some point, at the end of the day, the story people get bored, and they go back to the village, and they're tired, and they throng around the fire, and they start making up wild lies about fake people and fake events. And that whole time, the practical people are just out there working more. They're wooing more. They're hunting more. They're gathering more. And the point of the thought experiment is that, you know, obviously, we know how the experiment ends. The story people inherit the earth. The story people are us. But if we hadn't known that at the outset, wouldn't most of us have predicted that those utilitarian, practical people would have outcompeted the frivolous story people? And the fact that they didn't, that's the evolutionary riddle of fiction. That's one of the things I set out to sort of explore in the book.
Well, and what you're describing is community, the idea of handing down stories through generations, and the idea that the stories can tell us something about the world that we live in, whether even if it is fictional.
Yeah, yeah. If you were to ransack your own memory banks, and so everything you know, and sort of add up what you know from the classroom versus what you know from stories, my guess is that most of the stuff rattling around in your head comes from stories.
Yeah.
So almost everything I know about the legal system comes from stories, comes from CSI, comes from... Now, it's distorted. But I still know a lot more. I know I should lawyer up as soon as I'm arrested, you know. And I know that only because I watch a lot of cop shows. And so if you go through your memory banks, you'll find that a lot of the stuff you know, that fiction is kind of utilitarian. We do learn a lot of from it. We get a lot of vicarious, cheap experience from storytelling.
Well, as you said, it's so vividly on display with children, and I remember watching my own child as a little kid, a little boy growing up, and the kind of pretend and make believe that he either did by himself or did with his friends. And you have a picture in your book of your two daughters dressed up, and it's a lovely picture. As you say, their lives are drenched in make believe.
Yeah, it's kind of what little kids do, and yep. I sort of knew this academic level, but I was sort of lucky when I was writing the book that my own daughters were in the sort of golden age of children's pretend play. The young one was 4, the big one was 7, and this is the time when children all around the world are just in the sweet spot of make-believe. They're masters of riots and revels in Neverland. And so part of the research for the book was, you know, doing a lot of book learning and library learning and research and that kind of thing, but part of it was just watching them and playing with them. And kind of feeling awe-stricken by how natural this was for them to make up these stories. They don't have to be trained to do it. We never did it. We don't have to bribe them to do it like we bribe them to eat broccoli. They just do it with their skills and pretend developing in regular stages, just like other crucial human skills, like the ability to walk, like the ability to talk.
But what's so interesting about children's make-believe stories is that they're not necessarily about puppy dogs and pussycats, although they can be, but they're often, you know, filled with danger, with scary things.
Rabid puppies.
Right, maybe rabid puppies, right.
And dying kitties. I think most grown-ups have a tendency to misremember Neverland, to remember it as a sort of sunny bunny land, you know, where everything went great and nothing goes wrong. But we aren't remembering it right. Neverland is a pretty dark place. You know, so just the other day, actually it was about a month ago now, my younger daughter, who's 6 and still, you know, big into make-believe, has her friend over. And they immediately, you know, she comes in the back door and they hug and they say, "You want to play?" And, "Yes, I want to play." "And what do you want to play?" And my daughter says, "Let's pretend our parents are dead." And boom, I'm dead. And they go outside and they are running around the backyard and they're having a great time. But the scenario there inside is very dangerous. They're going through a haunted, tiger-infested jungle. I was killed by tigers, devoured by tigers, by the way. And they're fleeing and they're fighting for their lives. Children's Neverland is a pretty dark place, and that's something that Children's Neverland shares with the adult version. Adult stories are also all about trouble, all about strife, all about problems and conflict. Stories aren't about people having good days. Stories are about people having the worst days of their lives and trying to gut through.
I laugh not because I didn't. I thought it was funny that you were killed, but I can so identify with that particular scenario. But I think if you read or reread fairy tales, that tells you a lot about children's imagination, why these stories have prevailed. Stories of, as you say, of death, of evil stepmothers, all the things that would, one would assume, would keep a child up at night, but we read them as bedtime stories and off they go to sleep.
Yeah. And, you know, there's this feeling that we don't read our children's stories like that anymore. Like, you know, the Grimm's tales in the early editions were very, very dark, very bloody, gruesome, mutilations and all kinds of things. But I still read my daughter's Cinderella, or I did. And Cinderella, you know, has the worst gore is taken out of it. So at the end of the early versions, you know, one of the stepsisters has her toes cut off so she can slip them into the slipper, and then crows peck out her eyes. So that has been scrubbed out of the versions I read my daughters, but the story is still, the worst part of it is still there. You know, a little girl, her loving parents and protectors die and abandon her, and she is left under the power of people who absolutely despise her. And that's what we read them at bedtime. And, you know, when I asked my younger daughter about this, you know, I was reading her a collection of world folk tales for little girls. And I was stunned by how dark and dangerous and deadly the stories were. And I asked her, you know, this is are you scared of this stuff? And she's like, no. She's like, I love death. And what she meant by that was, this is fascinating to me. Right. You guys don't ever talk to me about death. You're hiding this from me. But I can go and I can learn about it in these stories.
You write about the Neverland the boys inhabit and the Neverland the girls inhabit. And from the outside, they might look very different. But from the inside, they have a lot in common.
Yeah, if you look at it from the sort of the outside, boys' wonderlands, Neverlands, are full of, you know, they're incredibly rambunctious. Boys are running around, they're shooting stuff up, they're a lot of rough and tumble play. Girls don't go in for that as much. But underneath, you find the same basic structure. I mean, you might look at the girls over in the corner, and they're playing in the doll corner, and they're playing mothers, and they have the little babies and so forth. But if you look a little closer, and you pay attention a little more closely, you see that they're also dealing with intense trouble. So maybe the baby's sick, or someone's trying to steal the baby, or the baby is being fed poisonous orange juice, or the baby is about to have its bones broken off. These are all examples from actual children's play sessions. So the key thing is that from the outside they look different, and the wonderland that boys inhabit is a little more filled with kind of hobgoblins and axe murderers. It's not so much in the same sort of day-to-day domestic strife, but it's all trouble focused.
But are you also saying, going back to those original fairy tales, which have, as you say, have been cleaned up for contemporary children, that we shouldn't abandon those gruesome, gory older stories, that there is something there that children really want to know and understand at that very base level?
Yeah, I do think so, and I don't think we have abandoned them. I think contemporary Moors have said that, you know, we don't want to have this woman's feet chopped off or her eyes pecked out in the story, but we do still tell this really dark tale about a little girl being orphaned. I mean, it's the worst thing imaginable.
Sure.
And then coming under the power of these people who absolutely hate her. So, yeah, I think that children can handle it for the most part, and we shouldn't be sanitizing too much.
About a minute away from our first break here, but using those as an example, which is how children try to understand this complicated, largely adult world that they live in.
Excuse me, could you ask me that again?
Sure. I mean, that these stories are really about children trying to understand the adult world.
Yeah, I think they're a form of a training for adult life. I think that's what children's pretend play is, too, as a way to sort of have a rehearsal, to build social intelligence, to build, the skills that you need to survive and thrive as an adult.
And that is Jonathan Gottschall, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the power of stories. He's written a new book called The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. And he's an English professor at Washington and Jefferson College across the state in Pennsylvania, in western part of Pennsylvania. His work focuses on this interesting intersection between science and art. And we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
Flipping through the radio, you're likely to hear the same songs over and over again.
But there's always a wealth of great music beyond the dial. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot.
And this week on Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show, Greg and I dig up a new batch of buried treasures. Tune in to hear these underground gems get some well-deserved airplay.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Rashern Baker was about to make a try for a demanding public office when his wife was diagnosed with dementia. But instead of hiding her condition, the family decided to go public with their challenge.
She was determined to handle everything, supportive of the children and of me, and we wanted the public to know.
We'll hear more of his poignant story next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about why stories are such a powerful presence and influence in our lives and throughout our lives. Our guest, Jonathan Gottschall, says that storytelling is about survival. It's about connection, solving existential problems. And his book is called The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's talk about adults. And I have to say, as I was reading your book over the weekend, I kept thinking of that TV show Breaking Bad, which is, you know, an extraordinarily compelling show about a teacher just, you know, as we watch his whole life fall apart. And I don't want to give too much of the plot away, but it reminded me just how powerful stories are for us adults.
Oh, I know. honestly, the best time of the whole week for me is the first 15 minutes of Breaking Bad.
Is that right?
Oh, I'm so happy. I'm so happy. And by the last 15 minutes, I'm very sad.
Yeah,
I know it's
poor
about
Mr. White, right?
Well, no, it's that I'm not going to get to watch it for a week. so I'll be deprived. Almost nothing in... I mean, one of the things that's kind of cool about the human mind is it's a wanderer. So the average person spends about 8 hours a day in daydreams. We're just doing it all the time. The average daydream is about 14 seconds long. We have 2,000 of them a day. So the mind is just flitting all around the place all of the time, except when it's in story. Huh. So the only thing that can still the wandering mind, that can slow it down and pin it down, is a good story. And so when we're watching Breaking Bad or reading a good novel, like a fun novel like Hunger Games maybe, we experience approximately 0 daydreams per hour, not 100 daydreams per hour. So it's kind of this altered state of consciousness that happens when you're inside a story. It's really cool.
Well, you know, that reminds me of that state that you get in when you're driving somewhere. It's been referred to as highway hypnosis, where you're, mm-hmm. you know, you're ostensibly driving your car, and apparently you are because you get from point A to point B. But during that time, you know, at least for me, I'm thinking about something else, and perhaps that's where all those daydreams come in.
Yeah. Whenever the mind doesn't have something really, really important to do, it gets bored and wanders off into la-la land. So while I'm doing this interview, I have something really important to do. I want to not screw up. And so I'm here. I'm paying attention. But the audience, you know, every now and then, they're gonna yes. start to fade. You're yes. going to start to wander off now and then. And you can't help it. Even if you're trying really hard to pay attention, the mind just starts making up stories. And so a lot of these daydreams are really mundane and boring. They're like, okay, I'm driving into work. What's, you know, let me run a scenario in my head about what would be the fastest route in. Other daydreams, though, are incredibly story-like. They're vivid. They're these daydreams where all of our, you know, our basest wishes come true, vain, aggressive, dirty. They're daydreams where our worst nightmares are realized as well.
Sort of like children, wouldn't you say?
I would say, yeah. I think it's all Neverland. Again, there's this idea that in order to be a grown-up, this is the great idea of Peter Pan. The idea is to become a grown-up, to really enter the adult world, you have to leave the nursery behind. You have to leave that land of fun, imaginative play behind. But humans really never do. We are, as a species, more like Peter Pan than we know. We're the species that just won't grow up.
Well, it seems like actors understand this. I mean, it is called play. You know, you go to see a play.
Yeah.
There's a reason it's called that.
That's right.
And actors have the ability to inhabit someone else's life and character.
Yeah. I mean, in the last chapter of the book, I talk a little bit about LARP. LARP is live action role playing. It's grown-ups playing at pretend. And I think it's really cool. LARP, though, has a horrible reputation. Like, I was a D&D, a Dungeons & Dragons nerd as a kid, and even we got to make fun of the LARPers. You know? It was even too dorky for us. But there's a sense in which, you know, what they're doing is they're running around and fighting and fleeing and smooching in Wonderland, just like actors do. Mm-hmm. For some reason, we really... love our actors for it, but when regular people try to do it, we consider it really dorky and pathetic. The one place where I think LARP is making a big comeback where people don't really realize it is in video games. So if you go into a world like the World of Warcraft, what you like about it is the interactive storytelling. You get to be a character in the story as it's happening. You don't have to watch the character from the outside. You are the character, and you get to help influence how the story ends. So LARP and role-playing games on the internet are really, you know, they're sort of an evolution in fiction in some ways. They're moving forward into this digital era, but at the same time, they're a devolution. They're moving back to the world of make-believe.
Well, let me get some callers into the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Jim from Elkins Park joining us on Radio Times. And Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thank
there.
You very much. A
You're
fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
One of the things I was thinking about children's play is, you know, you can think of it as being sort of specific to the story and sort of preparation in the event that that storyline might ever come to fruition. But it seems to me that more generally also what they're doing is developing like a muscle their imaginations, and that that's a critical muscle for success in adult life and in fact as an entire culture, and might help explain why the storytelling cultures have survived over the more pragmatic cultures, because they're going to have to invent alternative futures for very serious situations that have yet to even arise.
Well, Jim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jonathan, you want to respond to that?
Oh, I just think it's really well put, this idea of building up a crucial imaginative muscle. Yeah, the imagination is this incredible evolutionary adaptation. I mean, some people think it's a thing that brought us, you know, out of Africa. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that was the sort of crucial thing, the crucial step forward, this idea to have foresight. And foresight means, you know, you can see the future. The imagination allows you to see the future. It's not a for sure future. It's a probabilistic future, what will probably happen. But it's still this, you know, you're like a wizard. You're like you can see what's going to happen in the future and try scenarios out and without having to actually go through them and have the potential cost of, you know, making a very bad wrong turn.
And as you using the subtitle of your book, it's what makes us human and different from other creatures on this planet.
Yeah, this is one of the things that, you know, is really hard to study. But the question is, you know, to what extent are humans alone as storytelling animals? There are certainly sort of animal precursors to it. So, you know, when I'm at home with my dog, we'll play and we make believe. And the game is very clearly a game where we don't like each other. You know, he growls at me. I call him an old so-and-so and cuff him in the head. And, you know, he gnaws on my hands, and we pretend that we don't like each other. You know, we pretend to have these epic wars where I chase him around, he chases me around. So the precursors of story are there in many animals in forms of play. And with chimpanzees, there's some argument that perhaps they're doing, like they've seen like female chimps running around with little sticks that they appear to be treating like dolls. But they're not sure what's really going on there. The truth is, I think you have to have a pretty baggy definition of story to include other species within it.
And can I assume that when your wife plays with your dog, it's a different scenario?
She doesn't play with him very much. I'm pretty much the only one who plays with the dog.
Be known. And that's Jonathan Gottschall, the author of a new book called The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You kept a dream diary from a night, December 13th, 2009, and you wrote down a couple of your dreams. I'm going to read the first and the last that you have here.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, I dreamed it was Christmas morning. I woke up and realized that I'd neglected to buy my wife a present. As we began to open presents, everyone else in the family was happy, but I was perishing from anxiety. How do I get out of this one? The last one you write, I was at a resort, possibly the one where my wife and I honeymooned. An attractive woman was trying to have an affair with me. Before I could decide what to do, I learned that it was all a setup to blackmail me. Now, I have to say I've had my versions of those particular dreams. Was that a particularly bad night for you?
Oh, it was. Yeah, I wrote down four dreams from that night, and they were all horrible.
Yeah.
But the thing that's interesting about that is, again, it's sort of like the wonderland that children inhabit. We think it's nicer than it is. And the same goes for Dreamland. Dreamland is a dark and dangerous place as well. We say things like, oh, if only dreams came true, you know, but thank goodness dreams don't come true. Dreamland is a dark place. You would not want to live there. Most of the emotions we experience in Dreamland are negative. Sadness, fear, anger, rage, anxiety, and most of the events that occur there. So most of the plots of the dream stories we're living are quite dark. They're full of threat. They're full of danger. And so all of my little dreams that I recorded that night are pretty much characteristic of what dreams are like. They tend to be focused on danger and anxiety and trouble.
And Freud talked about dreams as wishes or wish fulfillments, and I guess dreams as a way of processing all the things that can happen during a day.
Yeah, and Freud isn't held in very high esteem by modern dream researchers. They sort of rejected this view, partly because they started doing empirical studies of what dreams are actually like. And they're done in two ways. One is, like, you know, they have people keep dream diaries. The other way is they have people in a sleep lab and they jostle them awake now and then and say, hey, quick, what are you dreaming? And they find that, you know, dreams seem like pretty much the opposite of wish fulfillment. You know, instead of being worlds where things go well, where your dreams come true, they're kind of the opposite of that.
Okay, fair enough. Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times and talking with our guest, Jonathan Gottschall. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me ask you a little bit more about some of the other things that you write about in your book. And one of the things that you talk about are memoirs. I happen to be in a memoir writing kick these days, having read Roger Ebert's memoir, Keith Richards' memoir, Diane Keaton's memoir, knowing that they might not be true. They're good stories. They're good storytellers. They might be emotionally true, even if they're factually untrue. How do you understand or how do you think about memoirs?
I think about memoirs. I mean, one of the ones, I mean, part of the inspiration for that chapter was this spate of fraudulent memoirs. So James Frye's memoir, for example, A Million Little Pieces, where he made most of the good parts up. And there's this hue and cry, and people get all over the author and demand their money back and brand them a liar and a cheat. And I'm not defending James Frye, but I find it kind of ironic because there's a lot of psychological research, memory research, that shows that we are all a lot more like lying memoirists than we know. Mm-hmm. We're constructing these sort of life accounts all the time, this sort of story of our lives about what our formative experiences were, what shaped us, who we are, what our personal qualities are like. And when you get into probing these things carefully, they don't really hold up very well.
Is it that we're misremembering or we're sort of editing or re-editing our life as we think about it or perhaps tell it
and
retell
that.
It? All of that?
All of that, yeah. So I think a nice metaphor for this is, like, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but it happens to me quite frequently. It's like I see a picture of myself and I'm rocked by the gap between how I thought I looked and how the picture actually says I look. And so the reason that this that a lot of people have this experience is that we form our personal sense of self mainly from mirrors. And when we stand in front of a mirror, we pose. We lift up our chins to, you know, hide our fat neck. We lift our eyebrows to smooth away wrinkles. We suck in our guts and that kind of thing. We arrange ourselves until the mirror tells us a flattering lie. It's us, but it's a version of us, an improved version of us. And I think that's a good metaphor for what we're doing all the time with our life stories. We're constructing a version that improves upon the real deal. So our memories are not nearly as reliable as we think they are. They're full of misrememberings and shapings that usually shape us in a sort of ego-enhancing way. And when it comes to our sense of our own personal qualities, of what we're actually like, we tend to radically overestimate. So psychologists call this the Lake Wobegon effect. We all think we're above average in just about any, like, positive quality a psychologist can dream up. So we think we're above average in looks and above average in smarts and above average in driving ability and above average in the likelihood of living a long and healthy life and not getting divorced. And just as long as you can make the list, we think we're above average. And of course, that's mathematically impossible, right? We can't all be above average. Right. So what all this research adds up to is this sense that, you know, we think of ourselves, us, as very stable, very real, but we are constantly, like, you know, sort of like a novel in progress is being constantly edited and rewritten and embellished by a narrator, us, someone who's not very reliable.
I don't know if you've had this experience, but there are certain stories that you tell about, you know, your life, perhaps from your childhood, and I've had ones that I've told to people probably more often than I should, and the more I tell it, the more I wonder, did this really happen?
Oh, yeah.
I do believe it happened. I don't believe I'm lying, but I, and I'm not clear, it's not clear to me that I'm even embellishing, but it begins to get kind of misty over time.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right. As you were saying this, I started thinking about conversations that men sometimes have together. I don't know what women do, you know, when they're having conversations amongst themselves.
Well, but we're utterly brilliant. That's all I have to tell you.
Well, men lie. Men lie to each other. It's just understood that they'll lie to each other. And so we meet up over coffee or beers. And there's a sense of, you know, there's a little bit of embellishment allowed to make the tale hum, you know, to make the story hum. That's what you're doing. You're trading stories back and forth. And the tales get a little tall. And I think it's the same sort of thing. It's not really a lie, but it's an embellishment of the truth for the sake of making a better story. And I think that's what people do when they're telling their little anthology. We all have this little anthology, right, of tales we tell over and over and over again that are supposed to be representative of our lives. And as we tell them, they get a little more polished, the rough edges come off, and they get more and more like fiction, even if they're communicating an underlying truth.
And oftentimes you'll learn that when your brother or sister says, that didn't happen that way.
Absolutely.
Right. Just to underscore that. Let me get Steve from Philadelphia to join us. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you. First of all, I want to say this is an absolutely fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much.
You mentioned the elements of storytelling as integral to human nature and human development. You mentioned the concept of misremembering stories, and of course, the tales get embellished. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how you feel that storytelling may have created or at least influenced the development of various religions and religious stories over history.
Steve, that's a great question. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Jonathan, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to me, if you look at a religion, any religion, and you start thumbing through the holy book, you find yourself in an anthology of stories. You know, in the West, it's the fall, the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, the crucifixion, resurrection of Christ. Religion is made out of stories. And for me, it's this sort of, it's a dominant expression of stories dominion over human life based upon what these sacred stories say. Many of us regulate all of the patterns of our lives, you know, what we're going to eat, how we're going to dress, when we're going to wage war in the name of everything holy. So again, when we're in religion, we're at church, we're reading a holy story, we don't often think about ourselves as, oh, I'm in storyland right now. But we are, and it's one of these great hidden ways that story interpenetrates just about everything that we do.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking with Jonathan Gottschall today on Radio Times. He's an English professor at Washington and Jefferson College in Western Pennsylvania. His work has been focused on the intersection of science and art. You can read his blog, The Storytelling Animal, at Psychology Today. You can also read him in his book called The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Fox Broadcasting Company. Presenting the season premiere of Bones, followed by the premiere of Mob Doctor. Dr. Grace Devlin is a brilliant surgeon indebted to the mob. Bones and Mob Doctor air tonight starting at 8 on Fox 29.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jeffrey Toobin about how the Supreme Court decisions on Citizens United and the Affordable Care Act will affect legislation for years to come. His new book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Toobin's also the author of the bestseller, The Nine. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
crying. Some of us do it more than others, and the result can be mixed. We feel better, worse, maybe embarrassed. And research tells us tears aren't just salty. They're a chemical mix that's different in men and women. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about why we cry, when we cry, and how crying works therapeutically. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Once upon a time, humans gathered around the fire to tell stories and to sing songs. Later, with written language came novels and magazines. With electricity came movies, TV shows, video games, social media. Why are stories such a powerful presence and influence in our lives? It's a topic for today's Radio Times. And our guest, once again, is Jonathan Gottschall, author of a new book called The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. And we have one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Hope from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hope, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
So my question is about mindfulness.
Yes.
And how mindfulness plays into what Mr. Gottschall is discussing, and how he feels about, like, sort of Eastern approach to mindfulness and staying in the moment and embracing the present. And if the counter philosophies like that are speaking to sort of an alternative to inner storytelling as a way to not feed into fantasy, but to find the sort of inner peace.
Hope, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jonathan, have you looked at mindfulness and meditation, things like that?
I haven't, and I didn't. I have to confess that I hadn't even thought about it at all while writing the book. I'm not steeped in Eastern religion or Buddhism or meditation or any of those things. But after the book came out, I did get a few questions like Hope's, and I think they're good questions. And it seems to me that what she's talking about is it good to try to shut down the inner storyteller? Is it good to try to suppress it at times? Does that inner storyteller that's racing all the time, making up stories, living in stories, dreaming up fantasies, is it making us unhappy a lot of the time? And I think there's some argument that it does, and I think there's a real insight there. Mm. But it's a tall task to try to shut down the inner storyteller. Meditation is one way it can happen, I suppose. But no, I don't have a great insight into that.
Hope, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But so much of our storytelling, as you describe it, is unconscious. I mean, we're not aware that our brains are constantly weaving stories as we live our lives.
That's right. Yeah, it's all on autopilot.
And I guess because what, the brain just is this restless organ.
Yeah, I mean, one neat line of research is from neuroscience where they have split-brain patients. And split-brain patients are basically people who were decades ago who had bad forms of epilepsy. And as a last-ditch effort, a sort of Hail Mary pass, they cut open the skull and they severed the corpus callosum, which is this band of tissue that connects the two hemispheres of the brain. And that seemed to cut down on the number of seizures. But it also had this effect of making it so the two halves of the brain couldn't communicate with each other. Mm. And so you could isolate the functions of each side of the brain. And in the left brain, they found this sort of what I've called the storytelling mind, this sort of inner storyteller that we all have. And it's on the job constantly. Its job is to filter through all of the data that's just constantly rivering into our brains from the world and to sort that data for story structure, for patterns of cause and effect. And it's a crucial evolutionary adaptation. Without it, our lives would be meaningless chaos, just noise, sound and fury signifying nothing. But the downside of the adaptation, the downside of the storytelling mind, is that the storytelling mind is allergic to uncertainty. It has to have a story. It has to. And if it can't find a story in the world, like an authentic story, it's only too happy to make one up. Huh. And so there's lots of really innocuous uses of this. So, like, I do a little experiment in the book where I show a stack of three unrelated sentences. And psychologists have shown that people have a very limited ability not to try to weave those three sentences together into a story. And that's pretty, it seems pretty innocuous, but then you look on the less innocuous side of the spectrum, and you get things like conspiracy theory, these fictions that people believe in that are based upon real data points and fake data points, but are basically based on the storytelling mind being in overdrive.
And trying to understand either things that don't make sense or crises in the world.
Yeah. Trying to find an explanation, this need for a story to give meaning and significance to our lives, to world events. To a lot of people, it just wasn't a satisfying enough story to see the 9/11 attacks as, 19 disgruntled hijackers. It had to be a bigger, the event was too big. It had to be a bigger story than that. It had to be the complicity of George Bush and the American government. So the story just wasn't good enough for a lot of people. So they invented a better one.
Let me get, looks like actually Kelly from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Kelly, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
In regards to something you were talking about earlier regarding mindfulness.
Yes.
As a writer, I think one way to shut down that inner storyteller is to actually sit down in front of a blank page. And Jonathan, I'm wondering what impedes storytelling when adults try to make it from whole cloth, and what causes writer's block. And in your research, have you found anything interesting in ways that writers have tried to overcome it?
Interesting.
Wow,
no question. Yeah, Kelly, go ahead, Jonathan.
I started to laugh into my palm there when he started speaking, because he's absolutely right. I'm a great storyteller until I'm confronted with that blank page.
Is that
and
right?
Then everything shuts down. Well, yeah, he's talking about writer's block. And writers have this love-hate relationship with their craft. You know, it's gives them meaning in their lives, and it's their favorite thing to do, and it's also their least favorite thing to do. It's really hard for a lot of us. How do you deal with writer's block? Well, I think that the best method that people have, that I've read about, for freeing up your inner storyteller when you're confronted with that blank page, is to commit to writing a really, really hideous draft. You know, the worst thing in the world. Just let the misery pour out of your pen. And the idea is that you get something down on paper. You get something really rough and gross down on paper. And then you start the process of shaping it and sculpting it and editing it and pruning it until you whip the badness out of it. But I think that what that little exercise shows is not that it's easy to shut the storyteller down, but people get intimidated by the necessity of writing a story that's polished and pretty and not redundant and where all the sentences sound good. That's the real issue. And so writing a bad first draft seems to free people up.
Kelly, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jonathan, you've written several books. Have they all been a struggle for you?
A brutal slog.
Really?
From beginning to end. Oh, yeah. I've gotten a little better at it. But, yeah, for the most part, I love the beginning where you have this creative explosion. You know, it's really, really fun. And you think to yourself, wow, this could really be the greatest book ever written.
And then that self-consciousness.
Then reality strikes. So the part, I love the whole thing, actually. I love the whole thing except for the first drafts where I tend to bind up. And again, the big breakthrough for me was saying, okay, you don't have to write a perfect draft. You can write a really bad first draft and then make it better.
Let me see what Randall from Norristown has to say. Randall, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right.
Hi there.
Hey, I wanted to thank you, first of all, for taking my question.
Sure.
But kind of wondering, you were speaking earlier how kids kind of do the storytelling thing in their play, and it's been shown that that's how they learn, that's how they kind of deal with the world and get to know it. Would you say that that is transferred over with adults when they are presenting some story to themselves, when they're trying to, for example, they're watching some show on television, and that is something of an escape for them, but are they also perhaps learning from that?
It's a good question, Randall. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. So, the question is, if this is the function it has for children, isn't it reasonable to suppose that it might have a similar function for adults? And yes, I think he's onto something. First off, I want to give a sort of detailed response. So the first thing to say about story, about the function of story, is we don't know for sure. This research is just only beginning. The second thing I want to say is, like, if you look at the, like, take your own hand, and you wave it around in front of your face, and you look at it, and you ask, like, what's this for? What's the biological function of this organ? And you'd start to say, well, it's obviously for grabbing stuff, and it's for fine motor manipulation, and it's for waving around in the air as I speak to communicate, and it's for caressing people, and it's for punching people. It's for a lot of different things. And it's obviously shaped by evolution to do multiple jobs. It's not a single-purpose tool like a hammer. It's a multi-purpose tool, like a Swiss Army knife. And I think that the story is going to have a similarly complicated evolutionary function. It's going to be shaped by multiple evolutionary forces for multiple things. But one of the things, I think, is just what he was talking about. So one of these ideas that it's getting a lot of play right now among scientists and scholars is this possibility that what fiction is for, or part of what fiction is for, is a sort of virtual reality simulator. So that as a pilot straps himself into a flight simulator so he can get all the practice and the problems of flying a plane without the potential carnage and hellfire of actually getting and learning in a real plane. Maybe that's what story's for, too. It trains us up on the big problems of human life and equips us to deal with them better. And there's actually some experimental evidence that suggests this might be true. So several different studies have shown that people who consume a lot of fiction outperform heavy nonfiction consumers in tests of various social skills and in tests of empathy, empathic ability.
Interesting. You know, I'm also thinking, and this goes back to the Republican and Democratic conventions, but also the way issues get talked about. The difference between a graph, which can be, you know, can give you a lot of information about the economy or something, versus someone telling you a story about their life and how it might illustrate the exact same thing, but why that story stays with you and the graph kind of disappears into the ether.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If we're Homo sapien, if we're a creature of intellect and rationality, why are graphs so impotent? And why do we need a story to move people? So again, they've done this. There's actually a lot of lab work on this, and they show that when you show people basically dry nonfiction, statistics, stuff based on arguments, essays, people are skeptical. They're critical. They have their guard up. They resist. They dig in their heels. They know that you're trying to manipulate them, and they think of counterexamples. But if you give them the same arguments in fiction, in a story, oh boy, the intellectual guard comes down. They're soft. They're easy to mold and manipulate. It seems to be that the emotional quality of fiction, the fact that you're transported by emotion, softens us up and makes us easier to influence. And so the studies have shown over and over again that people reliably move towards the story's perspective when it comes to values and political issues and moral issues and behavioral issues. Story, Tolstoy said, is an infection.
Yeah.
The point of a story is to infect the audience with the storyteller's ideas, the storyteller's emotions, and the science lab is showing that Tolstoy was largely right.
Interesting. Let me get to Amanda from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Amanda, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is going back to the how we were talking about play and with the guest's two daughters, you know, pretending that someone has died. Things like that, because I have two daughters, they're 5 and 3, and so they do a lot of imaginary play. And back in March, my father-in-law passed away, who they were pretty close to. So since then, they've kind of incorporated more death into their playtime, and you know, like the little brother dying or mom or dad dying. And my first reaction to that was, you know, that's not a very nice thing to play. Maybe we should play something else, but at the same time, I want to encourage, you know, their imaginations and let them, you know, play naturally without me interfering. So as a parent who wants to encourage that, my question is, how much should I sort of monitor their pretend play, or should I just back off and let them do what, you know, what their minds are at work doing?
It's an interesting question, Amanda. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jonathan, do you have advice for her?
Yeah, I'd back way off. Yeah. I'd back way off. I'd butt out. There's a great student of children's pretend play named Vivian Paley, and I draw heavily on her research in the book. And she, after teaching in teaching preschool for 50 years, came to the conclusion that children's pretend play is, quote, the place where bad things are rehearsed. It's a way of dealing with this stuff, of getting ready for it in your own life. And there's a lot of stuff that we don't think they're ready for. That again, it sounds similar to my little story about my little daughter saying, you know, I love death. I love exploring this topic. This is fascinating to me. And you guys are trying to hide it from me. And I don't think we should be censoring them or trying to steer them towards the sort of sunny, heavenly bunny land we think children's pretend play should be.
Amanda, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost out of time here, but you have a blurb from Jonathan Lehrer on your book. It says, enthralling. You also had a piece recently in Psychology Today because he was, found that he had both self-plagiarized but also had fabricated quotes about his own work. So how do you wrestle with, especially a book called The Storytelling Animal, a blurb from Jonah Lehrer and what your book is about?
It was a strange thing, you know. Jonah Lehrer was nice enough. He was a famously busy guy, less so now. And he gave us a beautiful blurb for the cover of The Storytelling Animal, and I was very grateful for it, and I still am. And then he had this horrible fall from grace, and so within like 12 hours, that blurb was scrubbed from the paperback version of the book. I feel a lot of sympathy for the guy. I think he came up as a blogger. He was very, very young when he got his first book contract. He was not a journalist, so he wasn't part of the fact-checker culture. He was not a scholar, so he didn't have the sort of visceral fear of plagiarism and lying and cheating that a lot of academics will have, that I have. It's a tragedy.
Well, Jonathan Gottschall,
and I hope he makes it back.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. It's been a really fascinating hour. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm proud to be on the show. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Jonathan Gottschall's book is called The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, and assistance today from Jonathan Bess. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.